So, Aaron, tell us, first of all, tell us about Say Nope to Dope. What is the what brought the organization together? Who are you?
Yeah, Say Nope to Dope is an alliance that falls under the banner of an American organization called Smart Approaches to Marijuana, who are a legislative lobby group that gives facts and recommendations to the U.S. Politicians. And so we have formed SAMNZ, which is an alliance of around 30 different organizations and individuals, most of whom are people who work in the drug rehabilitation area. There are some faith groups there. We have the New Zealand Christian Network. We also have the New Zealand Muslim Association. So we have quite a collection of groups who have come together under the banner of SAMNZ.
Okay, so the topic tonight is all about whether we legalise marijuana for recreational use, because obviously prohibition isn't working. And on your website, it says that maintaining its illegality, but using a smart arrest policy combined with the coercion of the law is the correct response to drug use. So what exactly does that look like? What is that?
Well, first of all, I think we need to be clear that whilst prohibition isn't perfect, one of the things that we want to be really clear about is what people often perceive prohibition to be about simply isn't accurate. So, for example, there's this idea that people who smoke marijuana will go to jail or be arrested. It's just simply not true. Last night, I was having dinner with a good friend of mine who is a senior police officer, and he scoffed at the idea that legalization would mean less police hours dedicated to cannabis. He said, Aaron, we don't do anything around cannabis. He said, if one of my staff arrested someone for smoking a joint, they'd have to come and explain to me why they did that. We don't arrest people for smoking cannabis anymore. We haven't for years. So this idea that kind of the options are a health approach or a criminal approach turn out not to be connected to reality. In fact, the only people who go to jail are people who sell, are people who grow. And under the new law, of course, if you do that outside of the regulated system, we'll need to keep sending those people to jail. So what we're advocating for is, in a sense, to continue down the road and strengthen what's already been the approach of the police, which is to use discretion to say, actually, we're not targeting users to put them in jail. We recognise that's not helpful. For 20 years, the police have treated this as a health issue. The only thing that happens to a user in New Zealand is a pre-charge warning. You don't go in front of a judge unless you're committing some other crime, in which case, yes, if you happen to have cannabis on you, you may appear before the courts as well. And that coercion of the law thing is a really interesting thing, because it means that we can trade off getting help against the criminal consequences of your actions. In other words, a judge can say, we're going to give you diversion if you go and get some help. We're not going to give you a record. You're not going to have the criminal penalties that you fear if you go and get some help. Under the legalization model, we have no way of actually getting people to get some help. Now, I know as a counsellor, people often come to help far too late. They wait till their life is falling apart before they get help, and even then are reluctant. So in actual fact, kind of strengthening the current approach in terms of really emphasising the need for helping people, but remaining the status that says, this is not something we're encouraging and this is something that we want to have some options around under the legal system, is something we want to keep moving towards.
So, Aaron, just to jump in at this point then, Aaron, yeah. How is that then distinct from if we're looking at, say, a decriminalisation model then? Because what you've spoken about there is the fact that the user is ultimately protected by the law and those, or not prosecuted rather, and then those who are distributing and selling would still be prosecuted. Would decriminalisation be something then that would be an option, or do you see still those as very distinct approaches?
Well, the sad thing is it's not an option because the government hasn't put it on the table. It's put legalization on the table. So, yes, it's fair to say that if decriminalization was on the table, we might be having a different discussion. But because I speak on behalf of several organizations, they have a variety of views on decriminalization. But what's fair to say right now is that we have an informal version of decriminalization. And so in that regard, we're really asking ourselves, do we really want to just fix a technicality by opening Pandora's box in terms of what legalization brings, given that legalization is actually commercialization? And that's the real challenge here, is when you set up another industry that we're not ready for, that's the problem. So our real position is we need to slow down. We are skipping steps. We are moving all the way through decriminalisation, right through legalisation to commercialisation in one step. Mm. We don't need to go so fast. Why don't we slow down, particularly given that legalisation is a new piece of legislation in many parts of the world, and we want to have a bit more time to see what actually happens, because the initial effects say that perhaps legalisation is not bringing about the effects they'd hoped for.
So on the website, for example, when we're looking at this, it's often contrasted with ending the, you know, the war on drugs, the quote-unquote war on drugs, and saying that, in fact, this is not a war on drugs. It's a defense of our brains and health. Wouldn't it be better then to put some laws around consumption and then roll out effective education or something like that? Is that a better approach?
Well, again, we're talking about false choices. There's no reason why we can't have education under the current model. There's no reason why we can't provide health services. Under New Zealand law, we don't withhold health services from you because you've committed a crime. If you speed and cause a car accident, we don't tell you, well, we're not going to fix your body. We still give you the same type of medical care as the person that you may have hit, even though you have committed a crime. So it's a false choice to say that you can't have health and education unless you have legalisation. You can still have under the current model.
So just to sum up then, Aaron, would you say then that Say Nope to Dope is about keeping the status quo, watching to see perhaps what other countries are doing and taking our time to get things in place a little bit more? Is that pretty much where your stance is?
Well, that's certainly part of it. The other part that just needs to be really clarified here is that legalisation does not bring about the effect that is promised, because it does not end the black market. So what it does is it creates two markets that start competing with each other, and the end result is that more people smoke cannabis than ever before. In Colorado and in Canada, since legalisation, their total cannabis market has risen from $5.5 billion to over $7 billion. We're seeing an incredible increase in use among teenagers. That's spiking all over the place. And because the products are now such high potency, the effects on people's mental health and well-being are shocking. So we're saying actually legalization is bringing the kinds of effects they suggested wouldn't happen. Under legalization, we're seeing four times as many people report psychosis and anxiety from cannabis use. Suicide rates among youth and with cannabis going up by seven times. These are some terrible outcomes, let alone things like drug driving, where we don't have the mechanism for testing people to actually prove that they're impaired. So yes, in one sense, we're saying slow down. On the other, we're saying because the things that are happening under legalization, we understand that the hope was for this protected little bubble, but it isn't working like that. Competitive forces are meaning that cannabis consumption is growing, and more people are using cannabis than ever before.
So just to clarify for listeners that are wondering, the THC in marijuana, can you explain exactly what that does to the brain? What is happening there?
That's a good question. The psychoactive part of the cannabis product, the THC, is what gives the high feeling, and with the high feeling activates the part of our brain that starts to augment reality. It's why we feel a little bit funny, we feel a bit giggly and want to eat something, but at worst, it triggers profound anxiety. In Canada, since legalization, every single day, 30 teenagers have been hospitalized because of the effects of cannabis. They've been freaking out. They've been having such terrible reactions that they've had to go to hospital. In Washington State, their poison center has had an increase in calls to their poison line of over 300%. 80% of the time, that's teenagers who are saying, I've just tried a cannabis product and I'm freaking out and I don't know what to do and I think I'm dying. So the experience is not the fun one that it might have been, because the THC has gone up so dramatically. Woodstock weed back in the 70s, 3% THC. In the 90s, it was 10% THC. Mm. And now your average street product is 30% THC, which means when the government wants to regulate it, one of the things that's going to happen for a lot of regular users, they won't even like the government product, because that's like offering them half-strength beer when they've been drinking full-strength beer for years. The reality is the products are more dangerous than ever before, and we're now seeing edible products with a THC level of sometimes up to 80%. Wow. I mean, for example, in Colorado, guys, there's a can of soda that has been infused with cannabis but the can of soda has a recommended serving, that it's 10 servings in one can. But when was the last time you ever opened a can of drink and thought, I need to find nine of my friends to share this with? You know, most people are going to drink that whole can. It has 10 servings of cannabis. That's like smoking 10 joints.
Well, and we've talked a little bit too about like what the protections would be on. When you talk about I guess that's the commercial you know, skin in the game, basically, right? That you can have a company that could sell a product that could be of that kind of potency and, you know, effectively, once they've sold it, they bear no kind of ill will or responsibility or whatever for what happens as a result. So are there any thoughts? I know that's part of your approach as well, has been to raise people awareness of the concerns. We had Ross Bell earlier on from the Drug Foundation saying that there are regulations to make sure, or they've been suggested, that would control the cannabis market from that kind of manipulation. Do you have a response to that?
Well, again, it's this problem of what the Drug Foundation are hoping for is a large, highly regulated market. What's true is it'll be a small regulated market. So within the bubble of the official shops, yeah, the products will have a low THC. But what that does is it tells the black market, the gangs, the tinny shops who've just lost a third of their income and are trying to work out how to recover that income, tells them that they need to specialise in the products not being sold at the shop. High-potency products, edibles, the things that won't be available. Mm-hmm. And this is the problem that really is at the heart of why we oppose this legislation, is that competition ends up creating the scenario we're trying to avoid. We're basically telling the black market what they should specialize in: high potency, low cost products. And in Canada, here's the problem too of the market. In Canada, a gram of cannabis is $10 from the official government shop. From the black market, it's $5, and it's twice as strong. And let's be honest, once you've started to cultivate the taste for the cannabis products, you don't want to keep spending a lot of money for a low-quality product. You're going to want to go down to the tinny shop and buy the high-potency product.
Well, there is a counter-argument to that, though, in terms of, say, applying to the alcohol prohibition argument, that actually the prohibition can lend itself towards the higher potency as well. So, for example, in, you know, using the alcohol example, pre-prohibition, Americans drank beer. During prohibition, because it was the most profitable means of, you know, gangs and underworld, you know, figures making money, they switched basically to whiskey. And then after prohibition was ended, people actually went back to, you know, lower strength drinks, so that prohibition in itself helps drive up the potency of the product as well. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, in the prohibition argument here with alcohol, firstly, we need to acknowledge they're very different things. The prohibition period you're talking about in the US lasted from 1920 to 1933. So it's about a 12, 13-year period of prohibition. We're now talking about a black market for cannabis that is decades long, a strong, robust industry. In Canada, their police chief described post-legalization the black market as vibrant. In California, it's been described by their police chief as robust. It's not going anywhere anytime soon. But the key thing is we're talking about a different kind of a product. Alcohol does not have the same addictive power as THC. One standard drink, guys, has 14 grams of alcohol in it. One joint has 0.10 of a gram of THC, 0.1 rather, a tenth of a gram of THC. So it's a far more powerful drug. One joint will get you high, one drink will not get you drunk. They're different things, and we need to keep that in mind, that once people get hooked on the high THC product, addiction will have its own power over that person's life, that it takes a lot longer when you're drinking alcohol to get to the stage where you're addicted.
Well, Aaron, thank you for being a part of our show as well and providing a counterpoint to the discussion we're having. So that's Aaron Ironside, spokesperson for Say Nope to Dope. Thank you for joining us, Aaron.
Thanks, guys.